We are in the WGXC studio with D.W. Gibson, who is currently the executive director of the Ledig House International Writers Colony in Ghent, New York, which is part of the OMAI International Arts Center. We are bringing you on the show today to talk about your book, Not Working. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So the title of your book is Not Working.
Very complex title.
People talk about losing a job and finding their way in today's changing economy. And you traveled across the country in August of 2011. Is that correct?
I was traveling during August of 2011, but I actually was traveling for much longer than that. I started about this time last year, actually. Drove out to California in just like 4 quick days, and then spent the next three and a half months sort of putting back across the country.
And you had modeled your book on Stud Terkel, and he had written a book in 1974 called Working, and he also has an amazingly great subtitle, which is People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do. And could you talk a little bit about how you came to come across this project? Were you asked to do the project? Did you find it on your own terms?
I sort of demanded that I do the project. I was talking to a friend, a guy named Colin Robinson, who's a really good book editor, and he had actually worked on this last edition that you have in your hand here of Working that the New Press put out. And so we were talking about Studs Terkel, just the fact that we really both loved his work, and Colin somehow wandered on to his own story of being laid off from a major publishing house in 2008 on what became known as Black Wednesday. And it was Scribner, and he walked me through that story sort of point for point. And it was sort of after his telling that story and having talked about Terkel that we just sort of arrived at this place that there needed to be a book that was in dialogue with that, that reflected what's been happening for the last 5 years, safe to say since 2007. So I set out to drive across the country, looking at communities that had the highest foreclosure rates at first as starting points, just trying to get a path for myself across the country, and talked to over 200 people. I had every person simply tell me the story of the day they lost their job, the day they found out that they were losing their job, and how they found out. And it's funny because most people sort of assume that their story is boring or like all the others, and they start by telling like a 45-second version. And then you ask a couple of questions, and you get like a 5-minute version. And then you have like 10 questions, and you've got like a 2-hour version. And always, there's so much, always so much emotion and all the nuance. Absolutely.
And you went around with a tape recorder and a video camera, correct?
And some very trusty colleagues and collaborators. I never could have done this on my own. So I was traveling, at the very least, with two people at any given time. MJ Sieber, who's a fellow filmmaker, and Mallory Avedon, who's a fantastic playwright. And my wife, when she could join us, although she was trying to hold down a job of her own in New York, so she was sort of joining us for legs at a time. And we were all required because it was a really frenetic pace. I mean, if we were in Fresno, California, we were researching Reno, Nevada, and looking for people to talk to in 1 day or 2 days or 3 days. And if we were in Reno, we were looking for people in Salt Lake City. And it was endless. So we were talking to people all day, and then deep into the night, you know, looking for people that we could find in a few days. So it was a relentless pace. It sounds like a lot of time, several months going across the country, but it's a big country.
Right. And also, what were the kind of boundaries? Because you could ask, I mean, so many people have been affected by at least losing their job within the last 5 years. Did everyone have to be fully employed?
It was really broad, actually. The only very important thing was that each individual was, whatever term we want to use, laid off or let go, certainly not terminated because of something they had done because of performance-related issues. So I wanted to make sure that it was related to the bigger economic picture. But beyond that, sky was the limit because you run into people in so many different circumstances. And one of the things I discovered while doing it is that in so many ways, work is evolving, jobs are evolving, and how we approach those things. And there are people that were self-employed that had a business that, you know, there's a gentleman in the book, Bob Bendig, who was a private investigator, had a private investigation company, and his section is called self-terminating because he essentially had to close down his business and let himself go, more or less. And there are a lot of people in those situations that were doing entrepreneurial work and had to terminate that work. And there are more traditional circumstances, corporate situations with the box, with the security escort, all of those elements that we might anticipate. And then there are, you know, people that were making $250,000 a year, people making minimum wage, people talking about the hardship of having to sell their boat, people in shelters with only 10 days left with a bed. So all kinds of circumstances. But really the notion that their layoff was a result of the economic downturn. The depression, the word we're afraid to use, but the depression.
Well, it was so interesting throughout all of the chronicle or all of the portraits that you wrote up in your journey was the notion of how much it affected not just them, but their colleagues that they had potentially been working with for 25 years, the relationship, their identity. And one thing I read in one of your articles was that you first asked everyone what their definition of work was. And then subsequently, what you end up finding in the book is how losing that identity or that notion of work then cripples their everyday in these really, really fascinating portraitures. So what I was thinking is I could ask you maybe what your understanding of work was after this project, and then maybe we could segue into Stead Terkel talking about his understanding of work.
Yeah, and I have a list in the book of responses that people gave to that definition of work. There is nothing I can say to summarize that input. What I can say is there's always a corollary between how much someone enjoyed the activity they were doing, their job, or didn't enjoy it. And I think sort of two responses stand out. One would be several people said that their work was identity. A professor comes to mind who absolutely loves the research he does and is completely invested in his work and sees no separation between life and work. And the other end of the spectrum, I met a gentleman who was in charge of public safety at a major university and I think was sort of annoyed by his job. And he hesitated for not one second. When I asked him to define work, he said it's a four-letter word. And so, and indeed it is. And obviously there's much subtext there, and it was a very negative thing for him. And everything in between. So I think it really goes back to how people feel about what they were doing, you know, how they define that word. And some people have a really positive portrait of that word, and some people have a really negative portrait of that word.
Mm-hmm. So we're going to segue into just a little excerpt of Studs Terkel, commenting on what it is to work. And just to give you a little pretext, Studs Terkel is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author whose searching interviews with ordinary Americans helped establish oral history as a serious genre. And he's widely credited as transforming oral history into a popular literary form. He had a very well-listened-to radio show in Chicago on WFMT Radio, which was started in 1958. And he has this really curious but gentle interviewing style. So we'll play this section, and what's important about these interviews is just that he often edited himself out of all of his interviews, and in these rare audios, he's in it, so you can hear the sort of gentle probing that he's perfect at.
I try to explore what I feel is uncharted territory. Example, work.
Thousands of copies. Duplicate pages exact and perfect to the tiniest detail. Thousands of copies. Duplicate pages exact and perfect to the tiniest detail.
Work is the prime impulse of human beings. What is the attitude of people toward their jobs? So I try to find people of all sorts of occupations, all sorts of work. What is your day like? Start from the beginning, the moment you wake up. For example, in the book Working, there's this funny guy. He's a meter reader, a gas meter reader, the one that comes in with a flashlight in the basement. There are two things on his mind, he's a meter reader's mind, dogs and women. And the first is the reality, and the second is the fantasy. So I say, what about women? Well, you know, a man's away, and once in a while, you get this feeling, you know. It's summertime, and it's a young wife, and she's getting the sun, lying on a blanket, lying on her stomach, you know, because she's got the bikini, but that top part is unbuttoned. She's lying on her stomach, you understand? So I creep along very slowly with the flight, and I holler, gas man! She turns around. Well, you know, I get bawled out an awful lot. She says, what do you mean? I get bawled out an awful lot, but you know what? It makes the day go faster. And I thought, makes the day go faster.
Do you have trouble collecting?
Yeah. I had one woman hide from me once, and I had another woman tell her kids to tell me she wasn't home. She says, Mom, newsboy. She says, him I'm not home. Tell him I'm not home. I could hear it through the door. She's not home right now. I go, okay. Came back in about half an hour and she paid me. They'll pay if you can get them, you know, like when they have any money.
So you mean sometimes they're ashamed to say they have no money and they hide?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah.
I mean, you do the work then primarily because of the money.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to have a little money once in a while instead of being flat broke all the time.
So what do you do with the money? Are you able to save the money or what?
No, I've spent it. Nearly everything I got this summer. Mom and Dad got real mad at me. I spent about $150 just this summer.
On what?
On nothing. I don't have anything to show for it. I'm like a gambler or something. The more I have, the more I want to spend.
How would you describe yourself? When you run into somebody, say, how would you describe yourself?
Oh, it'll sound terrible. Just a housewife.
What is a typical day like from the moment you get up? Could you describe it?
The first thing I do is come in the kitchen and have a cigarette. Okay. And then I put the coffee on and whatever else we're going to have for breakfast. Bacon and eggs, pork sausages, waffles, toast, whatever. And then I'll usually throw a load of clothes in the washer while I'm waiting for the next batch to get up out of bed. As low on the totem pole as I consider being a housewife, I enjoy it. I love every minute of it.
Why do you consider the housewife low on the totem pole?
Oh, because you look around at all these career women and they're really, you know, up there doing things, and what am I doing?
You really feel housewife is not a worthy...
If anybody else would tell me that, I would probably, you know, really talk back to them, but I myself feel like it's not, you know, a real... Anybody can do it. That's the way I feel about it.
So those were audio recordings from Studs Terkel's book, Working. He went across the United States and interviewed a bunch of people on what their notion of working was and collected a bunch of fantastic stories about their relationship to the notion of work. And if you're just joining us in the WJXC studio, we're sitting with D.W. Gibson, who wrote a book in dialogue to Studs Terkel's book, Working, called Not Working. I'd love to start with one of the portraits, because it's basically a series of portraits of various people's relationship to not working or them losing their job within the last 5 years during the economic downturn or the crisis. You structure the chapters as youth, then education, housing, community, corporate citizens, public domain, fringe, family, and evolution. What was the reasons behind the structuring of it?
It was hard to try to figure out how to order everything. And I ultimately just looked for those big sections that sort of kept coming up, those themes that kept coming up for people that seemed most commonly shared with a significant portion of the interviewees that would be in the book. And those are what developed. And they all seem to sort of speak to the notion that there's something beyond the immediate loss of the job, which is income and benefits, in those sort of immediate senses of security. A lot of other things going on in terms of people that are young at the outset of a career, sort of derailing that career, people changing careers altogether, having to sort of reinvent themselves.
There's a lot of stories. One specific that I thought would be interesting to start with is Ronnie Chambers, who was a career corporate professional for Budweiser, right?
Yeah.
And she had the rare unfortune of having to lay off a series of her colleagues. She'd mm-hmm. been working there for 20 plus years mm-hmm. or something to that mm-hmm. extent. And subsequently, once she had gone through the brutal process of watching, for instance, a 45-year-old man who had been working there his mm-hmm. entire life, his whole identity was impacted by mm-hmm. and defined by decision, she then also was fired.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk a little bit about her?
Yeah, she's a tremendous individual. She somehow has remained so calm and level-headed through all of her experiences. But yeah, she spent months and months, even before she had to carry out all the layoffs, or as she put it, separating so many people from the company. That's another interesting thing. There's so much interesting terminology and what words people use to describe the act of losing your job. But she spent so many months building up, as she called it, the George Clooney packet, referencing Up in the Air. making sure it was legally airtight, making sure it had everything it needed in it, going to work every day, working on those packets, seeing all the people that she knew were going to very soon be receiving one of these packets, and keeping that to herself. So difficult. And then going through that day where she led a team of human resource professionals that laid off, in her estimation, about 1,000 people altogether at different centers across the country. She oversaw the center in St. Louis, the home base, and her estimation was that she had laid off a couple hundred people in one day. And yeah, they flew a few people in, and she told about one gentleman who really sort of didn't know this was coming down the pike. A lot of people did. She said, you know, if you sort of attuned to things and paying attention, you probably had a feeling. But this guy hadn't been paying attention and totally was caught off surprise and just broke down. And she talks about the experience of taking his computer and his keys and his phone from him and then putting him back on a plane so that he was going to tell his wife and children that he didn't have a job anymore. That's quite an experience. And to have endured all of those stages and then to be laid off. And she knew that was coming down the pipe. She makes a very good point that she knew it was going to happen, and yet that helped her none. She had no ability to prepare herself for it, physically, mentally. And talks about that stage where she just sort of, that a lot of people talk about, where they just clamp down and go somewhere all alone. And as she put it, those were the days where she didn't, where she drank a lot, she ate a lot, and she slept a lot. Mm-hmm. But she really arrived at this terrific place. You know, she is in her 50s and after a long career, and it never really put together a resume, you know, hadn't looked for a job in decades. And when she, you know, hit the job market, realized it was an entirely different world. And that's something that a lot of people in their 50s and 60s have gone through when they had a job for decades. They never put together a resume. And so she essentially made the decision. She had enough financial stability in her life to not put herself through the devastating experience of being rejected over and over again. And she put her energy instead into a nonprofit called the Go Network of St. Louis, which is essentially a job club, job community for those in that city and the surrounding area to get together, to just talk, to have practical workshops. And I think that that's a fantastic place for her to arrive, a very generous place for her to arrive. And clearly she's being sustained by that experience now. It's definitely rewarding for her. Yeah.
And it reminds me of one man you interviewed, Elliot Parker, who's a professor of economics. Mm-hmm. And he said something in a portrait that you wrote of him. Human consciousness is hard to measure. I mean, what does it do to someone's self-esteem? What does it do to the way you feel about yourself? What does it do to your tendency to abuse your body through drugs or alcohol? What does it do to the long-run possibility in your life? All of a sudden, your opportunities are foreclosed on. You stop investing. And just like real capital, human capital depreciates if you don't use it. People become less skilled the longer they're out of the workforce, and this is a huge impact not only on the overall economy, but on the individuals. Some people lose their jobs, and for the rest of their life, they never get back to where they were. Yeah, some people lose their jobs, and it becomes a call to reinvent themselves. But I would argue that for every one of those, there's probably 5 people where the consequences of losing their job in the long run are huge. Could you talk a little bit about him or his comments there?
Yeah, that really sums it up. I mean, the whole project, I think. And he spoke very well to the deficiency of the unemployment rate that were given by the Department of Labor. And the fact that I think it's sort of pretty well documented that that number that we've been looking at, 8, 9, 10% over the last several years, is really not at all informative. The only thing that tells us is it allows us to judge sort of 1 year against another or 1 decade against another. It does nothing else for us. It doesn't measure people who have left the workforce and discouraged altogether, stopped, you know, given up looking, people that have taken early retirement. And it's really hard to gauge what that number might be. There are estimates out there, 17, 18, 19, 20%. But even beyond that, are the individuals who worked with a bunch of people and now are sitting around empty cubicles and they're sort of awaiting their own, you know, unkind fate. People who love or care for an individual who's lost a job, surely at some point you cross over to the majority. You know, if you're really trying to look at who's been affected, I think there's a really strong argument there that it's our majority, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he makes that point very well.
What is the impact that long-term unemployment is having on the individuals that you met and maybe America in general?
Mm-hmm. It depends on where the person is in their life and their needs. And it should be definitely underscore that many people don't receive severance, anything, any notice. A lot of people are cut immediately. But one gentleman comes to mind who actually, there's an excerpt of his chapter in the New York Times today. His name is Dominic Brocato, and he lives in Kansas City. And he, too, was a sort of corporate guy for several decades, very successful career. You can tell he was successful. He carries in his person. He's very articulate. He, when I spoke to him last summer, he had been out of a job for nearly 2 years. Mm-hmm. He had sent out, and he had been keeping quite accurate records on this, he had applied for 390 positions and had heard back from 20 people. He had spent thousands of dollars taking people to lunch, paying for lunches, trying to make connections with people. Wow. And I checked in with him recently, and he talked about how sort of just painful this experience was and how he felt like he was just sort of hitting his head against the wall. He was psychoanalyzing everything, thinking about everything that he was possibly doing wrong. And he knew that losing his job wasn't his fault, but he sort of questioned all of his moves after losing his job. Finally, when I spoke to him actually just a few weeks ago to check in with him and let him know that the piece was going to be in the Times, he told me that he had essentially abandoned the notion of finding a job, or at least publicly so, and had begun to tell friends and contacts that he had taken early retirement. And this seems to be only slightly less painful. The man wants to still be working. The man is still qualified to be working, and the man should still be working. But that's just a little bit more manageable for him. And so for people in that position, and they're again in their 50s and 60s on sort of that end of a career, there's a lot of that going on. That's pretty scary because that's pretty widespread. Mm-hmm.
Another pressing issue is then when people have been aligned with a company for many years, have health insurance, and then lose that when they've lost their job.
I spoke to Renee Mohammed, who was the first female ever hired by the Camden Fire Department, and she had lost her job, and she went right to the doctor when the firefighters were laid off because she knew she was going to be losing benefits and she wanted to get checked out. In that window of time, she discovered that she had cancerous cells, and she lost her insurance. She just sort of foundered for a while, and she was very lucky in that she was actually brought back through a government grant to work again and was able to reconnect with her benefits. And was able to get the cancer situation treated. But Dominic, the gentleman I just mentioned in Kansas City, mm-hmm. Has a pre-existing condition, had a very rare cancer in his leg that usually is dealt by amputation. He avoided that by going to a more risky radiation treatment. The cancer then developed in his lung. He had the lower left part of his lung removed about a month before I spoke to him. And he cannot get any insurance company in Kansas City to cover him because of this pre-existing condition. And he had this amazing moment he talked about with his doctor where he said, you know, when my benefits run out in August, and this was last August, I'm going to be able to come still see you. You know, how is this going to work out if I can't pay you? And as he recounted, the doctor just fell silent. He had no response for him. There are a lot of precarious situations healthcare-wise, and healthcare comes up again and again and again and again.
Yeah. I noted that, so I definitely wanted to get your input on that aspect. Unemployment is such a personal, oftentimes can be tragic, other times can be reinventing for an individual who's experienced it. But the important thing about your book is precisely that you kind of can tap into what the unemployment demographic is on a very sort of tangible, personal note. It's great writing, and you hear the voices of each individual across the country in it. So it was a fascinating read. DW, thank you so much for doing the interview with us on WGNC.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
I'd love to hear if people want to learn more about the project or want to keep track of the film as it comes together. How can they learn more?
Notworkingproject.com. We've got everything there. We got a trailer for the documentary, and we've got some other excerpts as well. So yeah.
Folks listening in Columbia Green Counties can also know that DW is right here in Ghent. So if people have more questions or want to learn more,
absolutely. I'm around.
So far.